We'll hear arguments first this morning in Robbins against California.
Mr. Chief Justice, good morning.
Just hold for a minute, counsel. Mr. Krause, I think you may proceed now whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Good morning, and may it please the court. This case is not about whether petitioners should go to prison for 30 pounds of marijuana. It's about my right to carry my private papers without government search, even though I choose not to carry them in luggage or briefcase. Even though I choose, for instance, to carry them in a heavy paper folder, which I normally do when I go to court on behalf of clients.
Do you ordinarily carry them in a plastic sack?
I don't ordinarily carry my papers in a plastic sack. However, should it be raining and I would want to protect them from the rain, Justice Rehnquist, I would certainly want that option without a policeman coming up and saying, I want to see what's inside that sack.
The question here is not how you do it, but how Mr. Robbins was doing it and the circumstances under which he was doing it. Isn't that the question before us?
That's quite right, but of course that question has great implications. And Mr. Robbins was doing it in this way. He had some packages, oblong packages, which were in the luggage compartment of his station wagon.
How did he happen to get stopped in the first place? Let's begin at the beginning with the facts.
He happened to get stopped because a policeman named Officer Depew thought that he was driving erratically, that he had crossed the center line, a dotted center line of a highway, and so pulled him over for investigation. And as soon as he pulled him over for investigation, Petitioner Robbins got out of the car and showed him his driver's license, and Officer Depew then asked for his registration, which Mr. Robbins had in, I believe, the glove compartment of his automobile. So he opened the door and went back into his car. Officer Depew followed him and smelled marijuana, the strong, pungent odor of marijuana, which was coming from the glove compartment, which coming from the passenger compartment of the car. He then, very soon, placed Mr. Robbins under arrest for driving under the influence of marijuana. A charge, by the way, which he was later acquitted on. After Mr. Robbins was placed under arrest, he was put outside of the of his own car, spread-eagled right above his exhaust pipe, and where he had to inhale the fumes of the exhaust, and soon was overcome by these exhaust fumes, became badly ill, and collapsed on the road.
Is that established in the record that it was the exhaust fume that caused this illness?
I believe it is established that that he was placed right at the left rear of the car where the exhaust came out.
The motor was running?
The motor was running. That is definitely in the record, Justice Blackmun. Yes.
Then, of course, you're just drawing a conclusion that it was due to the fumes.
Well, I think this was a conclusion from the fact that the motor was running and that he was spread-eagled right over the exhaust.
Well, is this important to your position?
It would only be important if we're worried about probable cause, which...
there's no question of probable cause to arrest, was there?
Well, there's no question of probable cause to arrest, no. But there is some question of probable cause to search, which, in all frankness, is not presented in our petition. So it's not that significant. What is significant is that soon Mr. Robbins found himself handcuffed and in the back of the patrol car, and the police started searching his car. Now, this is, of course, without a warrant at all. The first thing they opened up was a closed metal cookie tin, as it's been described. This cookie tin contained a small amount of marijuana, 1/8 of an ounce. Previously, the police officer had found a partially smoked cigarette, which he assumed to be marijuana, and a hand-rolled cigarette,
what if he had, looking in the back of the car, had found a paper bag that looked as though it contained a large bottle and opened the package, the bag, and found a half-consumed bottle of whiskey? Would he draw any inferences about that? Would he be entitled to draw any inferences that the erratic driving of the car might have been related to the missing part of the whiskey in the bottle?
Yes, I think that inferences could be drawn from such a discovery.
If he smelled marijuana and found a cigarette, could he draw any inferences that the marijuana smoking might have contributed to the...
Yes, sir. That's why he was perfectly justified in arresting Mr. Robbins for driving under the influence of marijuana.
In this case, I understand it. We assume there was probable cause for the search, but the issue is whether or not a warrant was required.
That's the issue. And I want to describe the way in which the 30 pounds of marijuana came to the attention of the officers, because that's the only issue really before this court. I might say that what was found in the cookie tin is not really before this court, in my opinion, because the Attorney General did not cross-petition for certiorari, and that cookie tin marijuana formed the basis of an entirely separate charge, possession of marijuana, which was dismissed, which was ordered dismissed by the Court of Appeal in California, because in that court, the Attorney General conceded that the cookie tin was covered by Sanders, and also the tote bag. There was a canvas tote bag that contained a little more marijuana. Finally, after the police officer unlocked the back door of the station wagon with the petitioner's keys, opened up the luggage compartment, and went through a briefcase and the tote bag, he came across two securely wrapped plastic packages. They were opaque plastic packages. No one could see inside those packages to determine what they contained. There's no issue about that. They were opaque.
How did he happen to go into the trunk?
He was making basically a general exploratory search.
Well, what I'm driving at is, did not your client say to him, what you're looking for is in the back?
Yes. He said that after the cookie tin had been entered and after it was obvious that the police officers were making a general exploratory search. Now, that goes to the issue of probable cause. Does that add to the police officer's probable cause? And as I've said, we didn't really raise that issue in our petition for certiorari, so really the warrant question is the only one that is fully before this court, although we do not concede that there was probable cause to go into the trunk in the first place, but we didn't want to bring that up precisely because we weren't sure that that would be an issue that you would be interested in at this time.
Let's focus on that warrant now for a minute.
All right.
I have a question to put to you. You have conceded that the policeman saw what appeared to be a bottle and on retrieving the bottle found that it was half consumed or half filled. What about, is that in plain view?
If the bottle is in a paper bag, it presents the difficult question, which was just handled by the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit in United States versus Ross in that en banc decision. It was handed down March 31st.
That wasn't a bottle of whiskey, was it?
No, that was, I think, some sort of controlled substance that was in the bag. I think my answer to that, to the paper bag having a half-consumed bottle of whiskey, is that this would truly be one of those questions that depended on the individual facts and the testimony. If the policeman testified that he could smell whiskey, that he picked up the bag and it felt like a bottle of whiskey to him, that it was on the floor of the car and he thought it was trash, all of those things I think would add to the factual issue, and on the basis of those facts, you would some judge would make the decision as to whether a warrant was required. In this case, I would say we have considerably stronger and better facts for requiring a warrant. We have a package. We have a sealed, opaque package. We have a package which we believe qualifies under the Jackson case which Chief Justice Berger cited and relied upon in Chadwick. And the Jackson case, of course, involves a package in the mail. But this court said in Jackson that packages in the mail are protected in the same manner as if the individual still had control of them before putting them into the mail. So I don't think that the Jackson case is specifically a mail case. The Jackson case is a package case. And it's very clear from the Jackson case that Justice Field, who wrote the case, and the other justices on the court at that time were clear that packages were protected by the warrant clause back in the 19th century.
Yet if the defendant in this case had been arrested on probable cause and searched person to a custodial arrest, there's no question that a package could have been on his person, could have been searched, is there?
Yes, Justice Rehnquist, I would question that. If a person is validly arrested and is carrying a sealed package, unless there's some emergency, I see no reason why probable cause for that package should not be presented to a magistrate.
How do you distinguish the Robinson case and the Gustafson case?
Well, I don't think that that case involved a sealed package. I would say that once you get rid of the emergency, once it's clear that the package has been taken away from the arrested person so he can no longer present any threat to the police officers, then I believe that package should be taken down to the station. If I'm wrong on that, it still doesn't make any difference for our case, Justice Rehnquist, because there's never been any contention that this was a search incident to an arrest in the Robbins case, nor has there ever been any contention that this was a consented search.
No, but there has to be some sort of line somewhere which police officers and ordinary citizens and magistrates can operate under without having it fluctuate based on the facts of each case.
Yes, and I think that I would like to suggest such a line, and we have suggested such a line. That is that where there is no emergency or no consent or other waiver, that if a policeman has probable cause as to a package or takes it into his custody incident to an arrest, that the warrant rule should apply. Because this court, for well over 100 years, has said that the warrant is the rule. And unless there is an exception found, there must be a warrant. The court has said many, many times that no amount of probable cause will serve as a substitute for a warrant. And I think, Justice Rehnquist, that is the easy line that can be applied by the officer in the field, that if there's an opaque package that he can't see, take it to a magistrate. Get permission to open it. Make sure that your arrest will stick.
Well, what do you do in the meantime with if you're by yourself as a law enforcement officer?
You're going to put the person you arrested in your patrol car. You also put the package in the patrol car, Justice Rehnquist. I think that it certainly couldn't be considered to be a burden on the officer to take, for instance, the two packages in this case and put them in his patrol car. He was going to take the arrested defendant into the station anyway. He wasn't going anywhere. He had a second officer with him. There was absolutely no burden or inconvenience. It would have been good law enforcement for that officer to do that. It would have validated his arrest instead of bringing it before the Supreme Court of the United States, as it is now. We thought about that, Justice Stevens. What if the suitcases are like the trunk in Chadwick, that it's so huge that it can't be moved?
You know, there are four or five of them. They'd be rather bulky to stick in
the back. Yes. If there is that problem, then I think that we have the same kind of a situation as is present under Chambers for an automobile search. And to whatever force the automobile search exception has, I think that same exception should apply to packages or piano cases or safes or suitcases that are too heavy to move. I think that the officer should have some attention paid to him. If he tells the court, the trial court, that he realized that he perhaps could have lifted up this suitcase, but it was too heavy and too bulky to put in his car and it would have caused him some inconvenience, I don't think that there's a court in the country that wouldn't give the credence to that kind of a judgment, because it's an officer in the field. This is not that kind of a case. This is a simple case. This is a case of a constable's blunder, and now both the state government and the federal government are trying to erode the Fourth Amendment to protect this simple arrest that should have been handled in the first place.
Suppose an officer has concededly probable cause to believe that someone either walking on the street or driving an automobile has illegal drugs in a plastic bag, an opaque plastic bag, and everybody concedes that there was perfectly good reason to believe that he was carrying such drugs in a plastic bag. And the officer sees the man, he has the plastic bag, or he stops the car on probable cause, and he sees that there's a plastic bag there. Now, I take it you agree he can arrest the man.
Yes, sir.
He can arrest the man based on the probable cause that he's carrying drugs.
Yes.
But he may not open the bag.
He may not open the bag.
He has to. It may be that if he opened it and it found that it wasn't, they didn't have drugs in it, he could let him go.
That's the same issue that was discussed by Justice Powell in this Arkansas versus Sanders,
right.
And he said if, and I think Chief Justice Berger said this too. If the man under arrest feels that he wants to surrender his right of privacy, he can do that at any time and say, "Look in my bag."
So you say to the man, "I'm going to take you and the bag to the police station, or I'm going to open the bag now if you will let me."
That's right. That's the Fourth Amendment. That's the protection of privacy. That gives our citizens the confidence that they have some control over our government.
And what about the statement, "What you're looking for is in the bag"? Do you have any comment about what that meant?
I don't know. I know that the petitioner had collapsed on the street and had vomited and was very ill at the time, and I don't know what it meant. Certainly there could be some very strong inferences drawn, and if the state had argued that was a consent, then perhaps we would have a more difficult case. But the state has never argued that is a consent, and that leads me to believe that even the state concedes that the statement was involuntary because the man had just been rendered unconscious by being forced to inhale his own exhaust.
Well, now, you've said that several times. Is there anything in this record that says he was unconscious because he inhaled exhaust or because he inhaled marijuana?
All I can say is that he seemed to be functioning before he had to stand over his exhaust pipe.
Mr. Krause, you don't challenge the opening of the trunk itself, do you?
Perhaps we should have, but we haven't, Justice Stevens.
That's not an issue here. Right?
That's not an issue. It's there are so many issues that we could have raised, but we decided to present the warrant issue as such, and we don't challenge the opening of the trunk itself, although I'm not conceding that a police officer can open a trunk in any circumstances.
By arguendo, by assumption, by hypothesis.
Yes.
Everything that happened up until the search of this particular container, you don't question.
No. Not legally. I would like to also point out that there are a couple of other important cases that apply the warrant clause to packages. One of them is the Walter case, as to which there may not have been a clear majority opinion, but it seems that five justices did join in those parts that say that those cardboard cartons that contain the allegedly obscene films were protected by the warrant clause. And then there's the Van Leeuwen case involving some boxes in the mail. I would also like to say that the warrant clause seems to me to be extremely important for another reason mentioned by Chief Justice Berger and Chadwick, and that is the separation of powers. The big problem with the writs of assistance was that they were executive warrants in England. They were issued by an executive officer to be enforced by an executive officer. And I think that separation of powers concept is extremely important, that wherever possible, we want a representative of the judiciary to pass upon whether our privacy should be violated, not a policeman acting on the street. And I say wherever possible because those are the compromises made by this court and accepted by society. If you have a situation where it's not possible, where there's an emergency, where there's a waiver, where there's a problem, then let the police officer do his duty. But I say, justices, that there is no such situation in this case. In this case, you had a situation of a very simple fact of putting two packages in, or maybe three packages in the back of a patrol car with the defendant. I would like to get a little bit to footnote 13 of the Arkansas versus Sanders case. That seems to be an unlucky footnote because although the court below relied upon it, the Solicitor General does not rely upon it, and the Attorney General of California merely makes the barest passing reference to footnote 13. Footnote 13, it seems to me, has two meanings. One is where there is something in plain view, and there was nothing in plain view in this case. There is no testimony about plain smell or plain feel or anything. The officer just said he saw these opaque plastic packages and he opened them. No testimony whatsoever about the officer could tell what the contents are. There is some testimony. In answer to a question from the prosecutor, the officer testified that he had heard that marijuana is sometimes packaged in this way. That was never put forth as a justification for his opening the packages. It was obvious that this officer was determined to open everything in the car. He had already opened a suitcase, a briefcase. He had already opened a tote bag, and then he got to the packages. The fact that he had heard that marijuana is sometimes packaged in this way does not add to any plain view showing. Then there's the part of footnote 13 that says the contents, where the contents can be inferred from the very container, it cannot support a reasonable expectation of privacy. And Justice Powell gave us two examples, a gun case and a kit of burglar tools.
I suppose a bottle with some brown liquid in would be something like that too, wouldn't it?
Yes, if you had a whiskey bottle, its contents could be inferred from its outside appearance. In our package, we didn't have that. In our packages, we didn't have that.
But preceding that, you had the odor of marijuana identified by the officer and marijuana cigarette.
Yes, in the front part of the car, but nothing, no odor at all from the rear luggage compartment, which was entirely separate. It's a station wagon, and the testimony was that there was a rug over the luggage compartment. You have to take off the rug and lift up the metal cover to the luggage compartment, and there was no testimony that he smelled anything at all there. I consider the gun case, I've characterized it in our brief, as a self-identifying container. And I would like to explain that if you choose to carry something in something like a gun case, it may be a gun, or conceivably it could be a fishing rod, or it could be your diary. But you choose to carry it in a container which suggests by its very nature its need for inspection, just as if you had walked down the street with a container labeled dynamite. I don't think you should expect that container would not be inspected. You have identified, you have invited, you have waived by that kind of a container.
Contrast that with the footlocker in Chadwick, where we had
leaking talcum powder, which the experts who had looked at it said was a sure sign of marijuana. And we had a dog who said, who smelled that and said, in his own inimical language, there's marijuana in this footlocker. Still, that was not self-identifying, Your Honors. A warrant was required. A warrant was required because it was closed, it was opaque, and the contents could not be viewed. I would say the same thing is true in this case. I want to... I think relevant to footnote 13 also is that petitioner had protected his privacy very carefully by the way he packaged the containers and where he put them. And I think all of the cases discussing warrants discuss that protection of privacy. And I might point out that anything could be packed in a plastic-wrapped parcel, from books to papers to marijuana. And I might also point out the converse, that marijuana can be packed in anything. And you could have a hunch, you could have a guess, but that's not sufficient for a warrantless search. That's not sufficient to qualify.
Well, here we assume there was probable cause.
We assume that there's probable cause, yes. Right.
The question is whether or not a warrant was required.
And
that's the only issue before us, isn't it?
Yes, and of course, we rely on no amount of probable cause standing alone can justify a warrantless search, absent waiver of emergency, Coolidge versus New Hampshire, and many, many other cases.
You're assuming, I gather, then, that if this same package had been carried as he walked down the street under his arm without being in any other larger container, it would have been probable cause to arrest him for possession of marijuana, if you're assuming probable cause for purposes of analysis here.
I'm not going to walk you into that one. I wouldn't say that.
You did a while ago. I asked you exactly the same question. You said, yes, there would be probable cause to arrest him even if you couldn't open the package.
No, I think your question assumed, Justice Wider. I understood it to assume that there was probable cause to arrest. And I think Justice Stevens...
Well, I asked you if there was probable cause to arrest because there was probable cause to believe that he was carrying... drugs in an opaque sack.
Oh, well, then I completely misunderstood your question.
There be probable? Excuse me. You can go ahead with Justice Stevens.
That's all right. I think both
already answered the question.
Both can be answered at the same time because merely carrying a plastic wrap package is not probable cause that package contains contraband.
Well, no, but I said that I asked you that suppose that that anybody would agree that the officer had reliable information that this man was carrying drugs in an opaque plastic bag.
Yes, sir.
That he did have probable cause to believe that. And everybody would concede it. And I thought you said that if he knew that, he could arrest him.
I did say that. And then Justice Stevens, I understood to ask me, suppose there wasn't probable cause to arrest, and the only thing you could see was a man walking...
...this particular package, which apparently some officers would consider... probably to contain marijuana.
Right.
The reason I ask you is I'm wondering if you could get a warrant.
Do you assume
or do you not assume that if they took the package out of the trunk and brought it in and set it on the magistrate's desk and said, I'd like a warrant to open this, what would the magistrate do?
I think the magistrate would turn down the warrant unless the additional facts were presented to him that also this man was smoking a joint of marijuana, a cigarette that smelled to me like marijuana, and here it is, and I can identify it as marijuana. Once you have connected the possessor of the package with other marijuana, I think your probable cause for the package increases. I'm not prepared to...
Would it be probable cause if it weren't in a plastic package or just to say a suitcase? Instead of a plastic bag, we had a suitcase in the trunk. And the officer took the suitcase out, took it to the magistrate, and said, this fellow was smoking marijuana when we arrested him. We want to open his suitcase. What should the magistrate do?
If I were the magistrate, I don't think I would issue the warrant. I don't think there would be enough. Unless the officer was willing to swear that this suitcase was treated in a manner that indicated to him that it contained contraband, such as the arrested party was very afraid and nervous about the package and things of that sort. If there were sufficient facts, yes. But standing alone, no. And standing alone, a man walking down the street carrying Mr. Robbins' two plastic wrapped packages, it would be outrageous to consider that a magistrate would issue a warrant for the search of that.
I take it the magistrate should not have issued a warrant for the cookie tin or the tote bag either if they'd been brought in.
If it weren't for the odor of marijuana, I would say the probable cause would be zero. But unfortunately for petitioner, there was the odor of marijuana and what appeared to be marijuana cigarettes.
See, the thing I'm trying to think through is whether the issue here is whether a warrant is necessary or whether a search can take place.
Well, the issue as we've presented it is whether a warrant is necessary. We have not raised the issue of probable cause. Now, the issue of what is a legitimate expectation of privacy has come up a lot, and I think that's an extremely important area for this court, because too many people assume that you want the policeman on the street to make some judgment as to a legitimate or a reasonable expectation of privacy. Justices of the Supreme Court, I don't think that's what you intend. I think that that is just a manner in which you describe the way in which you determine whether there has been a search or whether the person complaining about the search has the standing to complain about it.
What kind of judgments must the policeman on the beat make before he makes a Terry type of search?
I think that he has a lot of leeway there, and I think his...
All of the factors are subjective, are they, or are some objective and some subjective?
I think there's certainly some objective facts. In the particular case, you had to have individuals acting suspiciously, walking up and down in front of a store as if they were going to rob the store. And the policeman, maybe an ordinary citizen, might not have thought too much about that, but the policeman can use his expert knowledge and can infer that something's going on. But even then, you've only given that policeman the right to pat down the outside of the man's clothing to protect himself while he's detaining and asking questions. You have not given him the right to even enter pockets, or let alone suitcases or packages. So I think it is a different situation. But once again, justify.
In a Terry search, could he enter any package that might contain a gun?
No, sir, I don't believe so, unless the suspect could get to it. If he had a sealed package, for instance, it's highly unlikely that he could unseal the package before the policeman could do something about it. I would say if he was carrying an open shopping bag that he could reach in and pull out a weapon from, and the policeman had good facts from which he could say that there might be a danger to himself if he detained this man and questioned him about his suspicious activities without first protecting himself, I would say that he would have a right to pat down that shopping bag to make sure that there wasn't an easily reachable gun in it. Yes, sir. The last thing I want to say before I sit down and reserve the rest of my time is that the legitimate expectation of privacy, when you analyze it carefully, has nothing whatsoever to do with the warrant clause. It is entirely independent. The warrant clause depends on entirely different considerations, mainly dealing with the exigencies of the situation. Legitimate expectation of privacy deals with a person's ability to come to this court or any other court and say, my privacy has been invaded, my Fourth Amendment rights have been taken away from me. That is the confusion that the respondents have entered into. They have tried to confuse this court to say that legitimate expectation of privacy has something to do with, number one, the warrant clause, and number two, the policeman's decisions on the street.
Well, while I don't quite follow you as to the confusion that you say has been generated, doesn't the legitimate expectation of privacy govern as to whether or not your materials or your possessions are protected from seizure by the police?
The
That is not the test that the policeman should use. The
well, how about Katz and Rakus? Isn't that what it adds up to?
That's the test that the court used. But that's not the test the policeman should use. The policeman should use the test of, is this in plain view? If it's not in plain view, I'd better go get a warrant.
Well, I would have thought that the policeman should have used the test that the courts had laid down.
But I think that the test that the courts have laid down is to determine whether the person asserting privacy has the right to claim it. It's a standing question.
Well, but in Rakus, we held that it was not a standing question. It was a substantive question of what was and what was not protected by the Fourth Amendment.
It's quite true, but it's not the kind of test that you anticipate a policeman to use on the street. The test that you want a policeman to use on the street is whether there is some exception, whether there's plain view or whether there's consent. If not, when he's dealing with a sealed package, he should take it to a magistrate.
Then Rakus was wrongly decided, in your view.
No, I wouldn't.
Because you say a policeman shouldn't follow it.
No, I would say a policeman shouldn't have anything to do with that test. I would say the courts should follow it. That is the test for courts to follow, not for the policeman on the field. And that's where the respondents have confused the issue. They have asked the policeman on the field to make a judgment on reasonable expectation of privacy. They have asked the policeman on the field to look at my folder here and decide whether I have a reasonable expectation of privacy in these papers or whether I don't. The Solicitor General would say I don't because this isn't strong enough. It's only paper.
Well, but you have a right to raise that in a suppression motion. And if the policeman is wrong, you win.
That's right. And if the lower court is wrong, I have the right to raise it here. And that's exactly what I'm doing. I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Very well. Mr. Niver.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The search in this case, a roadside search of an automobile early in the morning, based on probable cause to believe that the car and its contents contained marijuana, occurred 6.5 years ago. At the time of the search, California and federal law was clear, it was unanimous, that probable cause to search an automobile for evidence of crime gave to the searching officer the justification to search its containers for the same evidence of crime. It was in reasonable reliance upon this rule, this California and federal rule, that the warrantless search took place. And it's for this reason alone that the judgment of the lower court should be affirmed. The officer reasonably relied on the law of the in existence at the time in conducting the search. But even if the search took place today, even if the search took place in 1981, we believe that the search was still lawful. Petitioner has contended otherwise, arguing that this court in Chadwick and Sanders announced a per se rule that all containers, all opaque containers, may not be searched without a warrant. In this case, of course, since the officer could not see into any of the containers, petitioner concludes that he should have gotten a warrant, and his failure to do so requires the suppression of the evidence. We read the cases not to go nearly as far as petitioner. In Arkansas versus Sanders, in this court's footnote 13, the court said that not all containers and packages found by police during the course of a search will deserve the full protection of the Fourth Amendment. And this court acknowledged that it will be difficult to determine which parcels taken from a car require the issuance of a warrant and which do not. So the task in this case is to determine which containers are protected by the warrant requirement and which containers may be searched upon probable cause alone. And at this point, it should be made clear that we are talking by hypothesis about probable cause searches. California is not arguing that a search of a container may be made without probable cause. Again, by hypothesis, there is probable cause in all search cases. So then we have to determine what standard should be employed to decide when a warrant is required and when it is not. And we believe that we should return to the rule in Katz versus United States, the formulation set down by Mr. Justice Harlan, and that is whether the possessor of the container has a reasonable expectation of privacy in the container so great that before the governmental intrusion can occur, a warrant must be issued. It brings us then to the question just what expectations of privacy are reasonable. And this court in Katz, in Justice Harlan's dissent in United States versus White, and in Regas versus Illinois, has told us that an expectation of privacy is reasonable when society deems it to be reasonable, when it is prepared to accept that expectation as legitimate. Now, this societal determination is based on the customs and values of the past and the present, and the extent to which a reasonable person's sense of security would be breached by the governmental conduct. Or to put the matter even more simply, will the search diminish the amount of freedom and privacy to a level inconsistent with the goals and values of this society? Now, we submit that the answer to this question is no. The search in this case would not offend society's sense of security.
Well, is that the sort of test, harking back to the colloquy that my brother Rehnquist had with your predecessor here at the podium, is that the sort of test that we can expect an officer on the beat to apply?
No, not without guidance from this court and from, of course, lower courts. The question is, in what containers does society...
When do you need a warrant and when don't you?
Exactly.
And doesn't the officer on the beat, shouldn't he welcome clear-cut rules one way or the other?
He should welcome...
Rather than a test that depends upon the expectations of society and for him to evaluate that?
He should welcome a test which is clear-cut. But the test must also be faithful to the history and the purposes of the Fourth Amendment. We have to accommodate both the values that the Fourth Amendment was intended to protect. We have to accommodate the interests of the private citizen in a sense of security.
That's what courts must do. But what an enforcement officer wants and needs, I should suppose, is working rules.
That's right. That's right. And so we first turn to this court's cases to determine just what are working rules. And we believe that a working rule and a value which is granted a high preference by the society are those repositories which are intended to contain personal effects. This phrase, repository of personal effects, has been used in at least three of this court's cases as a determining factor in whether or not a warrant was required. In Cardwell versus Lewis, in the plurality opinion in 417 U.S., the search of the automobile was upheld because the court said that it was not intended to be a person's residence or a repository of personal effects. The same phrase was also used in Chadwick in condemning the search of a footlocker, and in Arkansas versus Sanders in overturning the search of a suitcase. I think that this phrase, repository of personal effects, is a rubric which tells us, which this court has reflected, that a societal preference in a warrant to search such a receptacle. That is to say that a society, this society is interested
in... I know it's not an issue on this particular posture of this particular case, but under that test,
yes,
would the officer have the right to open the trunk of the car?
The trunk of the car? Yes.
Because that is not normally a repository of personal effects?
This court has upheld the search of a car.
Well, but that's then, this test is one you would have proposed just for containers.
That's right.
That are within a car.
Correct. Not the... All integral parts of the car may be searched upon probable cause. Cases Carroll, Chambers, Bannister versus Colorado, all those cases teach us that. It's as Justice Stewart would have it. It is a simple test for police officers to follow, even though it is true that personal effects are kept in glove boxes and in trunks of cars. Nevertheless, the case is now over 50 years old that cars may be searched.
Are glove compartments for personal effects?
Yes.
But you can go in there.
I distinguish containers of personal...
Isn't a glove compartment especially made for personal effects?
That's right.
But he can go in if he wants to.
That's right. Under this court's cases.
So what does that do with your theory that if it's personal, you can't go in it?
What this does with this theory is that in Arkansas
What about any locked compartment? Wouldn't that be an easy one to enforce?
Locked?
L-O-C-K-E-D.
Yes, sir. A locked container.
Wouldn't that be an easy one to understand?
No, the lock merely indicates...
You just think people just lock for the sake of locking.
Yes, but I don't think that the mere fact that there is a lock on the container indicates an interest in the privacy as opposed to the value of the...
What do you think the purpose of the lock is for?
To protect one's valuables.
Well, that's a personal property, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
For example, a toolbox. A person puts a lock on his toolbox because his tools are expensive, not because he has a privacy interest in the tools. Most people do not care if other people see their tools.
I don't know how you draw this line. I've had trouble drawing this line. I'm trying to say it's so simple. I guess the police have to decide what's best for society. And do you have a course in California teaching police what's best for society?
We have training for what's best for society? No, we try to teach them what is a lawful search. Turning to this question, what is the difference between a repository of personal effects and other repositories? I think that society places a great importance in protecting suitcase, briefcases, and the like from a warrantless search. But I don't think that society has a stake anywhere near as great in a toolbox or a cookie tin or a candy box or a Dixie cup or a grocery bag. I think that society is less threatened by the searches of those containers because the contents are less intimate and society has less need for constitutional protection.
Well, the problem is that what you and I might carry in a suitcase, people in a different socioeconomic strata carry in a grocery bag.
Perhaps. Yes. There is that possibility.
And yet, we're all protected by the Constitution.
That's right. I think that the test that we have proposed is that if the officer reasonably believes that a grocery bag is being used as a repository for such contents, it may not be searched without a warrant. But, for example, if the officer saw somebody come out of a grocery store with a grocery bag and also had probable cause to believe that drugs were in the bottom of the grocery bag, he would have no reason to believe that it was that person's suitcase.
If he came out of a grocery store with a little small brown bag, he wouldn't have much trouble, would he?
Even a large brown bag.
No, you know which little small bag I'm talking about. With the little glassine bag inside.
Oh, I see. Yeah. No,
he wouldn't have much trouble.
No, he wouldn't have any trouble with that, nor would he have any trouble with a larger brown bag into which he could not see. Because, again, there would be no expectation of privacy so intense to require a warrant. Now, it is true that this is a value choice that we are proposing, but we believe that it's supported by this Court's cases from Katz through Rakes, Chadwick, Sanders, and the like.
Well, when we talk about an expectation of privacy, do we need to distinguish between a legitimate expectation of privacy and an expectation in the abstract? Let me enlarge on that a little. I suppose if you've got marijuana in the bag, you certainly have a hope that it's going to be private. Was that not so?
That's true.
And suppose it's a pistol, loaded pistol.
Yes.
You certainly hope that that is not going to be detected by anyone.
That's right.
The question is whether there is a legitimate expectation of privacy if you're carrying a pistol or a piece of contraband. marijuana or opium or cocaine?
That's right, sir.
Now, I don't recall in your brief that you have undertaken to treat the difference between a legitimate expectation of privacy and a hope of what might be called a hope of privacy. Care to comment on that?
Yes, I think, Your Honor, that we did discuss the fact that under the CATS expectation of privacy formulation, there are two considerations. First, the discussion is contained on pages 32 through 37 of the respondent's brief, and that is that there is a twofold requirement, to use Justice Harlan's statement. First, that a person have exhibited an actual or subjective expectation of privacy, and second, that the expectation be one that society is prepared to recognize as reasonable.
That was just a concurring opinion in that case, wasn't it?
That's right, but that formulation was also appeared in the court's majority opinion in Rikers versus Illinois.
I wrote the opinion of the court, but didn't use that word.
I'm still worried about this purpose. You've got a briefcase with a lock on it, but it's not locked. It's open. And you've got a package that's racked up with sealing wax and tape and all.
Yes.
The briefcase has more privacy than the package.
Probably. If there is no reason for the officer to believe that the plastic bag contains personal effects. That's right.
Even though it's all sealed up with everything that he can find. Well,
for example, the plastic bag in this case could be seized by the officer. Every button, there is no dispute about that. Once it is seized, the thing inside is a tactile inspection of the package would reveal that the thing inside had the weight, shape, consistency of a 15-pound block of marijuana. And although it was not litigated in the trial court, it could not be because this was a pre-Chadwick search, it is inferable that it emitted a smell of marijuana. Now, under those... It is not in the record. It is an inference that we draw from the fact that the marijuana brick weighed 15 pounds. Under these circumstances, there is absolutely no reason for the officer to believe that that was any kind of a personal effect other than a marijuana brick. There was no reason for the officer to believe that this was luggage, that it contained the man's clothing, his papers, or anything remotely similar to personal effects.
Are you suggesting that the profile or silhouette of a marijuana block is comparable to the profile or silhouette of a fifth of a gallon bottle that liquor is normally contained in?
Well, of course, a profile of a bottle does not necessarily tell you that it contains liquor.
Well, but you start with the profile, and then you find that it's... got some brown liquid in it, and then by taking the cork out, you draw some inferences as to what kind of brown liquid. You detect the difference between iced tea or tea and bourbon.
Oh, I see.
Now, I'm asking you whether you're arguing that the shape of that block, which a policeman understood is the way marijuana is transported. Is something like the shape of a bottle that sets him off on the series of deciding whether he can make a search.
The shape of the package, in this case, the shape of the package would certainly tell the officer, together with the surrounding circumstances, that it was marijuana. That gives him probable cause. There's no question about that. But also the shape of the marijuana, together with what was almost certainly an odor of marijuana, would defeat any legitimate expectation of privacy in the contents of that bag, of the green plastic bag. So, yes, Your Honor, there is an analogy to be drawn between the shape of the brick and the shape of a liquor bottle.
Now, you haven't made any claim, I take it, that when this gentleman said, what you're looking for is in the back, by which apparently everyone concedes he meant in the trunk, that was a form of consent to the search?
It was never litigated as consent. Once again, it bears repeating because in 1975 we did not think that it was necessary to argue consent. It was only necessary to establish probable cause. We can't argue at this point that there was consent because there was no finding. It was never argued. We do argue, however, that it defeats not only the reasonable expectation of privacy, which we have been arguing, also defeats a subjective expectation of privacy on the part of the petitioner.
Mr. Niebuhr, this car was a station wagon, as I understand it.
Yes.
And I've heard repeated reference by both you and your co-counsel to the trunk of the station wagon. The station wagons I've been familiar with, and perhaps I'm just not up to date on them, have had decks, and you can get into them by the rear deck, by the rear door, by unlocking and raising the door, but they don't have a trunk the way an ordinary car has.
No, that's right. The rear door had to be brought down, and then the floorboard panel was brought up, revealing the what is effectively a trunk in the station wagon,
which is under the open deck.
So that it had a well basically underneath the deck.
Yes.
Left outside is also rug.
Yes, that's right.
That now, probably explains why he said what you're looking for is in the back rather than what you're looking for is in the trunk. Back of the
yes,
car.
That's right. The back of the car, which, if he had presence of mind to say back instead of trunk, question then just whether he ever was unconscious, as counsel has argued. So, getting back to our standard repository of personal effects, I think that this is supported by this court's cases, the cases which we have enumerated: Cardwell, Chadwick, Sanders. And it is also, although somewhat open-ended, it is nevertheless a rational test, because it is incongruous, I would think, to permit an officer to search a trunk of a car or a glove box of a car, but yet if he finds, for example, a cookie tin or a candy box or a soda cup in the trunk, to have him take it to a magistrate, put it before the magistrate, and ask for written permission to open it, to look into it.
This case doesn't involve cookie tins or Dixie cups, but rather sealed packages, from the appearance of which you cannot determine what that package contains. It's unlike a gun case, in other words.
That's right. But the rule that the petitioner is arguing for would cover all of the containers which I have just enumerated.
But the rule that you're arguing for would obviously cover, because that's what's involved in this case, sealed packages.
What we are arguing for is luggage or its functional equivalent. That would include suitcases, briefcases, and the like. It would not include a green plastic bag with a 15-pound marijuana brick in it.
Well, we're not talking about what's in it. We're talking about how do you determine what's in it. Do you need a warrant?
Yes, but what is in it is at least determined from partially can be determined from the outside, from a tactile.
Put it in this case.
It was clear that it was a brick and that it weighed 15 pounds or thereabouts.
Well, I asked you a question. Is it your claim that this is akin to a gun case? That one could determine that there was probable reason to believe that there was marijuana inside this,
based solely on the outside of the package? No.
Where this seizure was made, did they have dogs who could smell marijuana?
Did they have dogs
who could smell marijuana?
No, these were two California Highway Patrol officers. They did not have dogs.
I said, did the state of California have them anywhere in their police department where they could have been called in?
I don't know. The record is silent on that point.
The profile. May I ask, under your rule, what do you do about the very large, heavy piece of luggage, or say two or three big, heavy suitcases in the trunks? Now, they would, I take it, normally be, well, not only the functional equipment, their luggage. Does he have to haul those out of the car and haul them down to the police station and get a warrant?
Of course, it depends on the facts of the individual case. If it is highly impractical to haul such a container down to the police station. Though that might very well be exigent circumstances, such as as we recognized in Chadwick.
What would be the exigent circumstance?
The nature of the package itself is just simply impossible to haul it any place. The alternative, I suppose, would be to isolate it on the highway and call for this additional help, some sort of a large van. But of course, that is not the problem in this case.
Well, instead of one large suitcase, say there are about eight medium-sized suitcases, any one of which would be easy to handle, but you kind of convert a police officer into a bellboy, lugging all this stuff back and forth and filling up his car. It's your view that he would have to do that if there's a lot of luggage in the car and he wanted to look in any of it, I guess.
It's my view that we have to decide that on the basis of the particular circumstances. In this case of eight suitcases, perhaps if it could be done, if it could be carried to the police station, then I suppose it could. That's what he would be required to do. If it was simply too impractical, too inconvenient to do it, then I would argue that it creates an exigent circumstance.
What happened in this case when they locked him up? Didn't they take those packages?
Oh, yes. Yes.
They looked at him first.
They looked inside first. Then
you don't ask us to take another look at Arkansas against Sanders, do you?
I think that Arkansas versus Sanders is correctly decided on its facts, the facts being that luggage may not, without exigent circumstances, be searched without a warrant. What we are arguing is that luggage does not include every single opaque package within the memory, within the ability of man to conceive, that there are certain packages which society has decided are so important that that contain articles of intrinsic value, intrinsic privacy, that they may not be searched without a warrant. In this case, we don't have such packages. The argument that has been made by counsel that such a test which we have proposed is open-ended, is unpredictable, it would be difficult for a police officer to apply in each individual case. I think that can be answered by reference to the hypothetical in the dissent in Sanders. At page 772, Mr. Justice Blackmun listed eight containers and asked, would a warrant be required to search these? And he listed orange crate, lunch bucket, attaché case, duffel bag, cardboard box, backpack, tote bag, and paper bag. I think that under the test we have proposed, that an orange crate and a lunch bucket could be searched without a warrant upon probable cause. An attaché case and a duffel bag could not be. A cardboard box probably could be searched without a warrant, depending on the circumstances under which it was found. A backpack and a tote bag could not be searched, and a paper bag could be searched without a warrant. And again, returning to the facts of this case, there was absolutely no reason for the officer to believe that this contained anything remotely in the way of personal effects. Now, returning to the issue which we first raised at the beginning of the argument of retroactivity, I think that it bears repeating that this search occurred 2.5 years before Chadwick and 4.5 years before Arkansas versus Sanders. And applying the test of Peltier, 422 U.S., unless we are to hold that parties may not reasonably rely upon any legal pronouncement emanating from sources other than this court, we cannot regard as blameworthy those parties who conform their conduct to the prevailing constitutional or statutory norm.
Well, isn't it accurate that the original decision in this case by the California court was founded upon a theory that was later found to be invalid in Chadwick? And that decision, that judgment, was set aside by this court, and the case was remanded to the California court to reconsider the case in the light of Chadwick. And upon reconsideration, they totally abandoned the theory that since this was founded on an automobile, it could be searched, and espoused a quite different theory upon
which
their judgment is now founded. And therefore, aren't we faced, regardless of the retroactivity, vel non, of Chadwick, aren't we faced now with determining the validity of the foundation upon which the judgment of the California court now rests.
No, I don't think so. We have argued in the past that that Chadwick and Sanders were prospective. If the judgment
but
in this
even if that's true,
yes,
this judgment no longer is founded upon the theory found to be invalid in Chadwick.
But if the judgment in this case may be sustained, may be affirmed on the grounds of the prospectivity of Chadwick, then this court need not reach the correctness of the theory of the lower court.
I understand your argument.
Do you have some suggestions as to what case in this court Chadwick and Sanders overruled or upset, or do you think those were changes in the law?
It overruled no prior case, but neither did Almeida Sanchez found to be prospective.
Well, that isn't what I ask you about Almeida Sanchez. I'm just asking you about Chadwick and Sanders.
It overruled.
You think either one of them overruled anything?
No.
And weren't they quite consistent with past cases with respect to luggage?
They were cases of first impression.
Well, I don't know whether they were or not. In both cases, it had been argued personal effects like briefcases and luggage, you should be able to search them like you should be able to search a car because they were mobile. But that had never been the law before with respect to luggage, had it?
Not as to this court, but...
Were there cases like that in the Ninth Circuit?
There were cases like that in most of the federal circuits, cases which are recited in the brief. The cases in the state of California, including the California Supreme Court, and cases in other states. Cases prior to Chadwick were unanimous. Mm-hmm. The probable cause to search the car gave probable cause to search the
luggage.
And again, this is stronger than Peltier because cases were unanimous. And again, unless...
But we've never had a case here on it, had we?
No, you've never had.
Chadwick was not a case in which there was probable cause to search any car.
That's right.
Neither was Sanders.
There was probable cause to search the car.
The only contraband was in luggage and was known to be in the luggage. There was no reason to believe. In fact, that was a taxi cab, if I remember. There was no reason to believe that there was any probable cause to search any area of the car other than the particular piece of luggage.
The probable cause in Chadwick arose before the trunk was ever put in the taxi cab.
Correct.
So the fact that it was an automobile is irrelevant, is it not, in Chadwick? In other words, it isn't an automobile case at all.
That's right.
Just a coincidence that they had a taxi instead of carrying it by hand or with a wheelbarrow.
That's correct.
And there weren't any cases, were there a lot of cases in the courts of appeals and in the Ninth Circuit that if you had probable cause to believe that there was contraband in a suitcase that a man was carrying in a railroad station, that you could seize the suitcase and search it without a warrant?
I believe so, yes. That's Draper. That's this court's decision.
No, it is Draper. But that was a search incident to an arrest, wasn't it?
That's right.
Well, bear in mind that at least a couple of us in Chadwick thought it was an automobile case.
I'm aware of that, Your Honor. Thank you.
But if the probable cause had not existed before the trunk was put in the taxi cab, did anything about the movement from the loading platform to the taxi cab add to the probable cause for arrest?
In Sanders, you mean?
In Chadwick.
In Chadwick? I don't believe so.
The character of the material that furnished the probable cause existed before any taxicab was even in sight, presumably. Is that not so?
That is a fair statement of the facts of Chadwick, as I recall them, yes.
So perhaps you should have answered me that we, in effect, overruled Draper in Chadwick and Sanders.
Perhaps so.
Well, but Draper has been cited since then.
Yes, it has.
Thank you.
Boyd, while we're on that point, what's your view as to whether the probable cause was enhanced in any way in Chadwick by virtue of an automobile being involved? Or was the probable cause complete before the automobile came into the picture?
It was complete before the automobile came into the picture. But it was complete in Sanders before the automobile came into the picture, and you still could say that once it was placed in the automobile, I think it's a matter of semantics, whether you would say there was probable cause to search the automobile or to search the bag. There's probable cause to search the bag if it was in the automobile. The rationale of Sanders, which I think is important here, is that luggage and automobiles have very different privacy characteristics and values that are assigned to them by our society, so that the fact that the rule allows the search of the automobile on probable cause but without the warrant will not carry the day when what is inside the automobile is something which has more substantial privacy attributes than the automobile. Now, I'd like, in the limited time I have today, first to discuss why a petitioner is wrong in saying that the privacy expectations have nothing to do with the warrant clause. Now, the Fourth Amendment does not, by its terms, require warrants as a precondition to searches, but the Court has held that certain classes of searches will be unreasonable per se under the reasonableness clause of the Fourth Amendment unless a warrant is procured in advance.
Well, what the Court has really said, that all searches are unreasonable without a warrant, with certain well-defined and limited exceptions, hasn't it? Not that only certain classes
are. The Court has said several things, and I suppose we could go back and forth. I think there are statements that look in several directions, and what I would like to do is try to explain what I think underlies the reasons why warrants are required in certain classes of cases, and explain to the Court why, when you're dealing with containers that have lesser societal privacy values attached to them, it is appropriate for the Court not to require a warrant, but to permit
the
search to proceed.
The question is, what does the Constitution require, doesn't it? Isn't it?
Exactly, yes.
And the basic constitutional provision speaks in terms of
reasonableness,
not in terms of
exactly.
Warrants.
But the Court has, in some circumstances, and in the case of the search of a home, to take the paradigmatic case, it is unreasonable to search a home without a warrant because of the way our society views the interests of the individual in the home and the costs that are involved in giving the police free rein to go into the home based on their own judgment. Now, this case...
Well, just last week, within the last 2 weeks, we've indicated that point, have we not?
In the Stiegel.
In terms of the home being a place entitled to greater protection than an automobile or some other vehicle, a moving vehicle.
Now, this case, I'd like to begin by stressing that this case is not about the substantive criteria that govern a search. The police officer and the magistrate are looking to the same question, whether there is probable cause. The question, therefore, is not whether there is no expectation of privacy, in which case you're dealing with no search, but the magnitude of the privacy expectation. So the case is about Fourth Amendment procedure. Now, the decision whether or not to require a warrant involves, I believe, weighing the costs of requiring the police to secure a warrant against the potential benefits to be derived from the procedure. Now, let me talk first about the costs. I think people sometimes assume that the warrant procedure is entirely cost-free. That is not, in fact, true. Now, the costs are not prohibitive, and in many circumstances, the costs are well worthwhile. But the most obvious cost is the cost in police time. When a police officer seizes an item and it's required that he procure a warrant, he must carefully be sure that he puts in his search warrant application all the facts that he knows. In order to make sure that he's shown probable cause, he must be sure not to include inaccuracies or misstatements. It is a time-consuming procedure. During the time that this is happening, if he were not required to procure a warrant, he could be on the street performing law enforcement and community caretaking functions. So the question is whether this cost, which I don't want to exaggerate its magnitude, but whether this cost is worthwhile in certain classes of cases. Now, there is also a cost to innocent suspects, I believe. And I'd like to refer to footnote 12 in Sanders. The state made the argument that for an individual who is stopped on the street and is about to be arrested because the police have probable cause to believe that a package container or item that he has with them has contraband, the state said it's better for the police to make that determination then and there than arrest him and take him down to the station house. And the court's response was, well, he can simply consent. Now, I'll just mention one difficulty with that, and that is that a police officer does not have to accept a consent. And if a police officer has probable cause and he came to me for advice in an important case, I would tell him to decline the consent, arrest the individual, and take him in the container down to the magistrate, because the consent is a question of fact which will be litigated at the suppression hearing and may provide a basis for suppression of evidence that would not be available if the officer went ahead and obtained a warrant. Now, turning to the benefit side of the equation, the court's...
Well, are you saying any more there than that it is the shrewd, the safe thing to do is always get a warrant if you've immobilized the contraband or the object of the search?
If you believe you have probable cause. If you don't have probable cause, then you would accept the consent if a voluntary one is secured.
But you're not suggesting that you always must have a warrant if it's convenient to get a warrant.
I'm suggesting that requiring you – no, definitely not. But I'm suggesting that requiring the officer to procure a warrant will result in some class of cases in people actually being arrested and detained for a considerable period of time while a warrant is procured, even though either the warrant application will be rejected or in most cases will be granted, and it may turn out that there was nothing in the container after all that justified the arrest.
Well, by that, do you mean if he's arrested on Saturday afternoon, he might be detained until Monday?
I would hope not.
Well, what's the practice?
It's possible here at 2 o'clock in the morning, although there were independent grounds for the arrest, he might have been detained. But let me move over to the benefit side, because I think that is even more important to focus on. Now, the benefits of the warrant that involve elimination of general searches by specifying what is to be searched and seized are wholly inapplicable, it seems to me, when you're dealing with a container which has already been seized and you know exactly what it is that's to be searched. The benefit of the warrant that it provides notice of authority to the homeowner or a person whose property is to be searched is, again, wholly immaterial. That person has, in most of these cases, seen the seizure, and he is sitting in the jail while the warrant application is being prepared. Now, the third and the most important and relevant one here, of course, and I think generally the most important benefit of the warrant requirement, is that it serves a prophylactic function, that when the magistrate performs his role properly, there will be a certain number of cases in which the determination by an overzealous police officer that there's probable cause will be corrected by the magistrate and an unreasonable search will be prevented. Now, this benefit fully justifies the warrant requirement in cases where the costs associated with the unreasonable search are substantial in terms of an invasion of privacy values. On the other hand, it does not, it seems to us, justify the costs of the warrant procedure when you are dealing with containers that have lower privacy value. For instance, the dissenting judge in this case likened this container to a package of highway flares that he had recently purchased at a store and that were similarly wrapped. Now, I think the point that the court has to focus on is, suppose that a police officer, thinking that it was marijuana but not having probable cause, searched and found a package of highway flares. How much benefit would have been obtained to society and to the important privacy interests that the Fourth Amendment is designed to protect by going through the warrant procedure with the magistrate? So that I do think that the warrant requirement must be assessed in terms of the magnitude and nature of the privacy interest. I don't have time to get into whether these kinds of containers are of that nature, but I would like to address a point that Justice Stewart raised earlier, which is the clarity point. It's been suggested that if the rule is you must always get a warrant for any search of a container, that will clarify things and make it easier for the officer on the beat. Now, I agree that clarity is desirable, but I have two difficulties, I guess, with that. The first is that you must find that the Constitution requires it. Clarity alone will is not a sufficient virtue to require it under the Fourth Amendment unless the Constitution does. The second point, however, is that it will not eliminate the uncertainties that are associated, because it will simply move the focus of inquiry from the present focus, which the courts of appeals we submit have done a reasonably good job with, to a different place, to a shopping bag, a blanket, a paper bag, and so on. I see my time has expired. Thank you.
You have 4 minutes left, Mr. Krauss.
I would like to.
He had 2 minutes left.
I thought I had 10 extra minutes, but in any event.
No, you have 4.
Okay. Police are using warrants. I would like to report to your honors that they are being really used, and because of your decisions, and I think the whole country is should be grateful for that, and they can be used, and they can be used effectively. On the retroactivity point, there are lots of things to say. First, Chadwick and Sanders, by their own language, say that they are applying existing warrant requirements, and they are not new law. Secondly, the states are free to decide whether a particular decision of this court shall or shall not be applied retroactively.
Well, if you're correct in your first point, then the retroactivity question doesn't even exist, because retroactivity, Belnon, arises only if there's a change in the law.
Yes, that's my feeling also, and I agree with you, Justice Stewart, but some justices don't agree, and there are two cases that say that regardless of retroactivity, the states have the right to choose themselves, and I'd just like to mention
those. Well, states certainly, if there was no change in the law, no state has the right or the freedom or the privilege to disregard a constitutional decision of this court, does it?
No. No state does have the right to do that, and I'm sure they wouldn't. What is a legitimate expectation of privacy is something that's come up quite often, and Justice Rehnquist has defined it in the Rakes case in a way which is very good, and I don't think it's the kind of test, Justice Rehnquist, that you would want the policeman in the street to apply. It's in footnote 12. Legitimation of expectations of privacy by law must have a source outside of the Fourth Amendment, either by reference to concepts of real or personal property law, or to understandings that are recognized and permitted by society. Now, that's a delicate concept, and the best test for the policeman in the street is whether he can see what's in the package or not. If he can't, he should go get a warrant, and that's an easy test that he can apply.
Was the bag in this case referred to as opaque? Is it the kind that Jonathan Winters advertises on television, the kind of dark green, hefty type?
No, you can't say that it was a bag at all. All you can say is that they are oblong-shaped packages that are sealed with masking tape, and they are covered with something like burlap, and then over that there is a green plastic. We don't know where the green plastic came from, so they were not garbage bags, and it would be a misstatement of the records to say that they are. And also, it's a misstatement of the record to say that there was any smell in connection with these packages, Justices. There was not any smell in connection, nor was there any feel in connection with this package. Chief Justice Berger, was there any evidence that any tests were done, that this met any profile of marijuana? As we've pointed out, the courts have gone to great lengths to say that marijuana is normally wrapped in butcher paper, marijuana is normally wrapped in burlap, marijuana is normally in 2.2-pound kilo packages. We have a 15-minute—my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in New York.